Welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today, we're going to be discussing the human rights and forced labour risks for business at the point of recruitment. Recruitment is often the stage at which workers and supply chains are most vulnerable to falling into modern slavery and bonded labour. In many instances, workers are forced to pay fees to recruitment agents and middlemen for the right to work. It's present across many sectors and supply chains. And it has been an issue of focus for NGOs, campaigning groups and civil society for some time. But now, leading companies have also recognised the problem and are taking action. Over the next hour, we will discuss the employer pays principle and assess the latest company commitments towards responsible recruitment. We'll also consider the challenges companies face in implementing such commitments in practice and some of the ways to tackle them. We have a panel of experts to lead our discussion this afternoon. We have Brent Wilton, Director of Global Workplace Rights with the Coca-Cola Company, Doug Nystrom, Director of Human Rights Supply Chain with Walmart, and Cindy Berman, Head of Modern Slavery Strategy at the Ethical Trading Initiative. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Shen Mushtaq, for convening our panel today. Now, the issues we'll be covering will be among those we'll discuss in depth at Innovation Forum's upcoming conference on modern slavery, forced labour and human rights, which we will be convening in London on the 18th and 19th of October. Full details of this interactive and engaging event are on Innovation Forum's website. The link is in front of you now, where you can sign up for best price passes. And I hope you can join us. Back to today, I will shortly invite our panellists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions, particularly during the second half of our hour. Please note that, as at Innovation Forum conferences, to keep things discussion-based, there will be no slides. We do want to hear from our audience, so please do submit questions using the questions box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panellist in particular. And if you can keep your questions short to the point, it is more likely that I will use them. So, turning to our panel, Cindy, perhaps you could go first to set the scene a bit, around the employer pays principle, what it is aiming to achieve and why, and what trends you're seeing through the work of the ETI. Cindy.
Thank you, Ian. The employer pays principle is very simple. As you have indicated, many workers that find themselves in a situation of modern slavery have been found to pay recruitment fees to secure their job. So the employer pays principle simply states that no worker should pay for their job. And that the costs of their recruitment shouldn't be borne by the worker, but should be paid by the employer. In addition, where workers have paid recruitment fees, that these need to be reimbursed to the worker as part of their right to remedy, because many of these workers end up in a situation of debt bondage, having made the decision often to migrate for jobs. They are charged by a number of recruitment agents that operate either in their local village or in a particular sector and charge exorbitant fees. Many of the employers that are recruiting migrant workers are also paying for recruitment. And there are a number of middle men, as it were, that are reaping the benefits of this that end up making vulnerable workers even more vulnerable because they are indebted as a result of this fee. Many of them end up paying back the recruitment fee for the first sometimes 6, 9, 12 or even 18 months of their job. So before they're actually earning an income, they are simply repaying this recruitment fee and getting themselves out of debt. The Ethical Trading Initiative, a lot of our members are recognizing this as an important risk to them in relation to their modern slavery obligations. The UK Modern Slavery Act requires that companies produce a modern slavery statement, but the UK is not alone. There are many other legislative requirements now on transparency and due diligence that are prompting companies to think very hard about the workers that they have in their supply chain, even fairly deep down their supply chain, and to consider what they need to do. And a number of our corporate members have signed up to the leadership group on responsible recruitment. Many of them have spearheaded efforts at the Consumer Goods Forum. We are heavily engaged in the Sustainable Development Goal 8.7 with the ILO and other international forums to try to address this as a collaborative effort. It does involve quite a lot of collaboration, as well as really understanding what the issues are in each context and ensuring that we're not simply taking a face value approach to this issue and trying to understand what were the drivers and the mechanisms and how to address what is an endemic risk in many supply chains.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. Just going back to the levels of fees, you said that it takes up to 12 months sometimes for workers to pay back the fees. So what sort of level of fee are we talking about then for these workers?
It varies a lot. In some places, Bangladeshi workers, for example, have paid something like $3,000, which is well over what the average wage is in Bangladesh. And they have managed to raise that money either through the family mortgaging their land, through using money lenders, through taking out a debt through their recruitment agents. In other places, it's a bit lower. And obviously, the type of work that those workers are going to do when they are abroad varies considerably. So some have been deceived into being told that they will be earning considerably higher wages than they actually will be. And then it's going to take them a much longer period of time if they end up in a very low paid job, for example, as a construction worker in the Gulf States or a domestic worker. It will take them a very long time to repay those wages. The recruitment fee, because their wages are extremely low. But it does vary, and some countries have really taken important steps to limit the amount that any worker can earn abroad. For example, in the Philippines, they have very clear standards, for example, for care workers about what they should be earning abroad, and have very clear benchmarks about whether workers are permitted to pay any kind of recruitment fee. But in many other countries, governments have simply failed to take responsibility for regulating recruitment fees in the recruitment industry.
Okay, thank you very much, Cindy. Brent, turning to you, perhaps you could outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Coca-Cola and what the employer pays principle means for your business in particular. Brent.
Yeah, thanks, Ian, and thanks to the Innovation Forum for including me in this panel. I think Cindy has started off this discussion setting a very clear framework within which we're all trying to address this vexing issue around human trafficking, modern slavery. For us, we've been dealing with this space for a number of years, and initially we engaged around the issue of retention of passports. That was the first big tranche of work that we did back in about 2011. And then, of course, with changes here in the US around federal contracting, with Obama's executive order 13627, and then federal acquisition regulations coming into play in 2015, it meant that we had to get ahead of the issue. And one of those issues was the payment of fees, because, of course, as Cindy said, this is often the catalyst by which people then get trapped into a lifetime of misery and debt bondage. So we moved very quickly around 2012 to do some survey work within some of our markets where we knew that there were corridors of migrant labor. And this was for us, particularly in the Gulf. So we went out and did a survey with a third party just to see what the instances were in terms of the legal environment. And of course, what we found was that in many of those countries and in other countries today, local law actually allows for the charging of fees. So you've got an immediate challenge when you're dealing with suppliers, particularly local suppliers in those markets, who believe that they are legally entitled to do what they are doing. And I think Cindy's point about cooperation and engaging with governments to get them to start changing the way in which they regulate their migration policy is very, very important to help companies operate in a better environment where the charging of fees is outlawed. And I think we're seeing a trend towards that, but it's incredibly slow. And so as a company, we decided to take a principled approach with regards to these issues. And we put them together with regards to both non-payment of recruitment fees, and that includes transportation fees, bringing people to or from a country. We also included making sure that contracts of employment were presented in a clear and truthful manner, and that copies of those contracts that people signed are kept and available for inspection. We also do the requirement that people have access to their identity documents. And we require our bottling system and also our suppliers to have in place management systems which ensure that those obligations are met on an ongoing basis. We also, of course, undertake a third-party auditing of our business in order to ensure that these issues are addressed. But it's not perfect everywhere. There are still challenges in those countries that do allow for fees to be charged, particularly within our suppliers. But we're doing a lot of work on a collaborative basis with other brands such as Walmart in order to get out amongst the community of suppliers to the world's transnational businesses to understand that this desire to move away from the model whereby people pay for a job is something that not just the Coca-Cola company or Walmart or Mars or one individual company expects, but all of us expect. And that if a supplier wants to enter into the global supply chain of any of these large brands, then they need to position themselves to make sure that they are not charging fees for people working in their business. So I'll stop there and see if there's
anything else
you want to explore.
Thank you, Brent. The point around confusion, I think, is an interesting one. To what extent do you find that there are companies in where you're operating or you have supply chains where such recruitment fees are indeed against the law or illegal, but they're still being charged?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue that you've always got the black market. And that's why one of the things we're trying to do with the leadership group and the employer pays principle is trying to shift the recruitment market. We're trying to identify those recruiters that exist in any market that are not charging fees and to steer business towards them and to move business away from those who support the payment of fees. But this isn't easy either because it depends very much on what the buyer of those services requires. And we've seen instances with one recruiter where they'll do no fees, they'll do partial fees, or they'll do full fees, depending upon what the client wants. And so the game for us as well is not just to shift the recruitment market, but through the collaboration exercises, and Cindy mentioned the CGF and the Consumer Goods Forum and the leadership group, is to shift businesses to understand that this is something they're going to have to correct and that they cannot persist in doing what is illegal in those instances where fees should not be charged. And then again, you have to be very mindful that these things morph over time. So, for example, when we had the issue around retention of documents, passports were returned, but other legal documentation was seized. And so you've got to continuously, like whack-a-mole, go around and make sure that you're addressing through the systems you have in place, morphing within the industry, so that we are able to get a firm hand on no charging of fees.
Thanks, Brent. It strikes me that this is an area where a lot of collaboration is possible between brands and companies. So let's come back to that perhaps a little bit later. Doug, I'd like to turn to you now and put the same questions I put to Brent to you. So perhaps you can outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Walmart and what the employer pays principle means for your business. Doug.
Yeah, thanks. thanks as well to the Innovation Forum for putting this on and inviting me to be part of it. And thanks, Cindy and Brent, for setting this up. You've laid out all the points so far. Just to help everybody understand the Walmart context, if you don't already, we're large, largest private employer in the world, largest company by revenues with $500 billion, 2.3 million associates. We're in 28 countries, 11,700 and something stores. That's 54% of our stores are outside the U.S. So given that context, you would think, well, you could just do it yourself. But I want to just come back to the point that's already been made and say that in this area, especially, collaboration is critical. This cannot be done by any one company. There are too many complexities to the way workers are recruited. There's too many government issues. There's different suppliers. There's different sectors. And so as a company like Walmart, who crosses electronics, apparel, food and beverage sectors, we can kind of be a convener or be kind of a bridge to different sectors and kind of bring them into this tent, so to speak. So on our journey, similar to what Brent was saying, you know, we've decided a couple of years ago that the way to combat forced labor was through the recruitment of migrant workers and through the employer pays principle. And so we joined the leadership group for responsible recruitment. We're also part of the Consumer Goods Forum that's already been mentioned as well. I sit on the steering committee for the Responsible Labor Initiative, which comes out of the electronics industry, but is broader than that. It's open to non-electronics as well. And they're doing some good work in this area. On the government side, we're part of the Bali Process Government and Business Forum, where we're interacting with the governments in the region of South Southeast Asia to discuss human trafficking, forced labor, and we're putting recruitment of workers as a key part of that agenda. And that just the second meeting just took place in August in Bali, Indonesia. But there's a collaborative piece where it's absolutely critical to the success of this. Individually, we've added it to our standards. So we've embedded the recruitment of workers and the payment of fees by the employer into our supplier standards. We are focusing as a member of the leadership group on Malaysia and Thailand. And so within those two countries, we're working with the International Organization for Migration to map out our supply chain and then dig into where the labor is coming from in those two countries and then do some training of the employers and of the workers and then even of the labor brokers. We're working with the ITSRA Institute as well. Through our foundation, we funded them, and they ended up creating an app for workers from Myanmar to Thailand so that they can kind of rate labor brokers and kind of share their experiences, so that kind of like Yelp, you can kind of find who's a good labor broker, who's not. We're also doing some other data things with them, some responsible recruitment work of employers so that they're trained. We're also, some of our supply chain is going through a program that the Responsible Labor Initiative is also putting on, called the Responsible Workplace Program, where employers, workers are being surveyed, and employers and workers are having training to try to move them to a place where they understand how this should operate and to become more satisfied in their work as well. You know, it's part of audits. We have third party audits. We have different audit schemes that are approved. That's sort of the first line, you know, where, how do you find it? Hopefully we can find it in audits, and we're working with these audit schemes like SMETA, at SEDEX, like BSCI, ICTI, RAP, the Responsible Business Alliance audit. And we're trying to get them to come together and actually do a job of finding the fees, finding the problems in a better way. We've embedded into our, we have training portal for our suppliers, and we've embedded responsible recruitment training into that so that suppliers have access to that. We have in our department close to 200 associates around the world, and a lot of those are actually engaging with suppliers. And so they follow up, they will visit facilities, they work with our sourcing teams and try to find this. We also have an investigation team that if allegations do come up, they can go in and actually verify those and find out if they're true or not. But all that to say, this is a, just come back to the point, it's a complex problem. Simple solution is that employers should pay, but getting to that point is going to take a huge effort in collaboration. And I believe in that, you know, we've got to come with one voice across sectors, across suppliers, across retailers, across brands like Coca-Cola, and have that same voice so that it doesn't be like whack-a-mole, as Brent was commenting. So that we can actually, if it pops up in our supply chain and we get it and then it moves over to somebody else's, they have the same voice and the same requirements.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Doug. Let's go back to Cindy in a sec. But Doug, just with you for now, when a company is moving then to a employer pays principle, and trying to get rid of worker paying recruitment fees, what are the immediate challenges that making such a move throws up?
Are you asking me as a retailer?
Sure. Yeah. What are the challenges that you want to make this change? What are the immediate challenges that it throws up making this change?
I think the first challenge is finding it. The audit process doesn't necessarily always find it. There can be ways of hiding it. There can be imperfections in the audit process. And so that's why we're working with these audit schemes to improve that. I think sometimes the quality of auditors as well. So finding it is key. And then trying to... If you think about it, it's an economic problem. We're trying to disrupt a business model and replace it with a totally different business model with, and that's got incentives and motivations built into it, and they can be different from place to place, but quite simply, it's a supply and demand. And so right now, if you tell your supplier, recruit responsibly, they're going to want to go find a responsible labor broker. That supply has to be increased as well. They got to be able to find one. And so there's a challenge there that is still in its nascent stage so that they can't necessarily identify who those responsible labor brokers are. And then I think a big challenge is the government, the regulations, the lack of enforcement, the cultural differences from one country to another. Going beyond the government, more of the culture, I think that's another challenge where one culture may view people from another country a different way. And so, and then I'll throw out one more challenge, and that's the workers. The workers, in our experience, they don't trust that you don't pay for a job. And so there has to be some education on their part. It makes sense to me too. I mean, I don't know that I would trust that I don't have to pay to get a job in another country, but we've got to be able to educate them and tell them, no, that's the way it's going to be now.
Great. Well, thank you for throwing up some fascinating challenges, Doug. Cindy, perhaps I can go back to you at this point. I wondered if you'd be interested in commenting on what you've heard from Brent and Doug and how important the leadership of such companies is in pushing this work forward. And then also, from your perspective, who do you want to see taking responsibility for this this process? Is it companies? Is it other actors? But, where do you see the real driving force for this? So, Cindy, back to you.
Thanks, Ian. I think Brent and Doug have outlined the issues really clearly. To add to the mix of some of the concerns and challenges around this, I think Doug has said that this is a business model question, and disrupting the business model is what's at stake here, involving multiple players. For me, that is a critical question also for the brands and retailers, their own business practices, their own buying practices, and the stress and pressure that a lot of suppliers are facing in meeting their own demands and requirements of the buyers and retailers and the brands. Puts them in a situation where they are subcontracting, using agents, using temporary contracts for workers, involving the more vulnerable workers that often are coming across borders, as we've heard, rather than local workers. I think all of those, the work needs to be signaled right from the top, as I think many of as Coca-Cola, Walmart, and others have signaled. But I think the question of who actually pays and how much is paid and what the relationship is with suppliers, what we are finding at the ETI is that we are challenging companies to develop more of a partnership model approach with their suppliers, not simply a compliance top-down, we expect you to meet our requirements, but saying, what is it that you need from us, including a look at what the purchasing practices are, whether the prices, the terms and conditions, the repayment terms, the expectations that are placed on them to meet all these requirements, whether they are being adequately compensated to pay decently, to ensure that recruitment fees are not paid, and to use those more responsible recruiters. That's the one challenge, I think. And I think the other challenge for me is that as much as we are seeing leading companies drive this, the retail sector is obviously not the only sector that's implicated, although they tend to be the main sector that is taking ownership of this agenda. There are many sectors in which highly vulnerable workers are operating, where there's no brand to whose reputation needs to be protected or whose values are such that they are driving this agenda. And so I think what we need to do is have an honest conversation about what needs to change in the overall engagement with governments, not only with migrant workers, but ensuring the things that Brent has argued, which includes having a decent contract with agreed terms and conditions, with a decent wage and working hours, in which workers are not threatened or undermined in their efforts to earn and find a decent job. So I think there are many questions and concerns. We need to continue to engage governments. We need to continue to engage beyond the retail sector or consumer-facing sector to those sectors like the construction sector where these problems are endemic.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. In fact, and thank you also to our audience for all the questions that are coming in. They're coming in thick and fast. And Cindy, I wonder if you could just expand a little bit on what you're just talking about just now, and it will answer a question from the audience. What other sectors are there then where point of recruitment risks are endemic. We've also talked about retail. You mentioned construction. What are the other sectors, very quickly?
I think what we're seeing is that logistics has been completely missing in this agenda. The transportation of goods and services, catering, cleaning, other kinds of services. The finance sector, I think, is well behind the curve on some of these issues, but they are starting to think carefully about what they're investing in and how. And I think, obviously, domestic work is a critical one, where I think the most vulnerable workers are sitting. Really, often these are women. They're subject to sexual abuse and exploitation. They have paid recruitment fees. They're often locked up in people's homes. They're invisible from the public eye. I realize this isn't the normal market for Innovation Forum or the people on this panel, but it needs to be considered within the mix, because we all have homes. Some of us are, have the opportunity to address these issues, including gender considerations across the board. Sorry, Ian, the one other thing I think that we need to throw into the mix is the whole question of remedy and repayment of these fees. And that is a complex question, but I think as much as companies are driving the requirement for workers not to pay a fee, they also need to own their responsibility in thinking through how workers are freed from that debt bondage in the interim.
That's exactly one of the questions that our audience have put in. So I'd like to put that question, in fact, to Brent and Doug. So Brent, for you, how in practice can recruitment fees be reimbursed, and how do you ensure that that process happens? Brent.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, as Cindy has been saying, as Doug has been saying, there's no one size fits all to this. But we have a process whereby, in terms of the Coca-Cola company and the plants and the operations that we actually own, which I can give the quickest answer to, when a person is recruited, if they've come in from overseas in particular, but not only, part of the inquiry will be whether or not they have actually incurred the payment of fees. And if the answer is yes, we ask to identify what those fees are, and then they are reimbursed by us directly, probably in their first pay, if not soon after. So you've just got to ask the questions. I mean, the thing is, and then Cindy's made the point, there's not many sectors in the country or in the world that are excluded by this. And you can't assume that someone that's coming to you for a job is not dead bonded from a job that they had two or three before you. So you've still got to keep asking the questions. And this is particularly the case in vulnerable markets like the Gulf. And so we make sure that that is done systematically. If we're bringing people into our employment who are not nationals of the Gulf countries, that obviously have come into the country through the permit system, hopefully that exists, but that permit system often carries with it fees. And so we have to inquire. You've got to ask the questions.
Sure. Thanks, Brent. Doug, turning to you then, what do you do to ensure that if recruitment fees have been incurred, that you identify them and they're reimbursed?
Yeah, thanks. I think in this area, again, it's not a black and white issue. And I think, as Brent mentioned, we don't own these facilities that produce these things that we sell. And so we don't, it's not like we're finding it within our own employees. These are employees of probably two tiers away from us. So what we do is we treat it as a case-by-case basis. Have a discussion with the supplier, with the facility that the supplier is using, and try to work out the best way to remedy that. Examples of that have included looking at, okay, what's the average for workers from different corridors to that country that are working at that facility, and let's use that as a basis to determine what the fees are. Or we've seen facilities actually say, okay, yeah, we'll pay them, but we're going to have to do it over 12 months. And so So those are some examples of how we've dealt with it.
Sure. So thank you very much. Another question came in, which I think it really gets to the nub of solving the problem. And the question asks, how should companies draw a distinction between recruitment fees and other costs that may or may not be incurred by an employee to move from one country to another? For example, is a passport application, should that be paid by the employee or a plane ticket or a visa? You know, when is it the responsibility of the employee? When is it the responsibility of the employer or the middleman to deal with that? Brent, let me put that back to you.
Yeah, I think, again, I mean, Doug's made this point and Cindy has as well. It's a case-by-case situation. But generally speaking, if we are looking to bring someone from overseas to work for us, we cover their transportation costs to and from. That's taken care of. If they require a visa because we want them, we'll pay the visa. We don't pay for people having passports because there's also the issue of being travel ready that needs to be borne in mind. So you've got to look at it on a case-by-case basis. In some instances, it may require a person who is moving to undergo quite extensive medical treatments with regards to vaccinations, etc. Again, we look at that on a case-by-case basis. So there's no one general rule on that.
Thank you. Doug, do you want to pick that up?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Just say that, you know, the overarching thing is that workers shouldn't be required to pay fees for their employment. And so kind of go through some of those fees and figure out which ones are valid, which ones aren't. You know, it can get really, really difficult to sort all those out. And there's still discussions being had. ILO's having a discussion in November on what are recruitment fees. The Responsible Business Alliance has some guidance. If you want to go look at that, you can see how they've defined fees. And it's essentially, if it's a cost that that is related to, let's say, use a U.S. example. Like if I'm putting my resume together, that's not a recruitment fee. So if you can kind of identify the cost of me getting prepared to get a job versus the costs that are associated with actually, okay, that person is calling me to be their employee. You know, those costs are more likely to be included in recruitment fees.
Sure. Cindy, do you want to jump in and do you have anything from ETI on that point? You know, what actually is a recruitment fee and what are the other associated costs of moving to a job? I mean, where do you draw the line?
Doug and Brent have indicated there's quite a lot of work underway, the Federal Acquisitions Regulation. They're also about to publish their own definition. The ILO is working on it. There are various organizations that are trying to define this more specifically, and I'm not going to comment on those. I think that is a valuable work that's underway, but at the risk of being a little bit controversial, I think we are slightly at risk of going down a route of being so technical and specific and focusing so much on the detail of recruitment that we miss the point about what makes workers overall vulnerable to modern slavery and exploitation. And I think that we need to take a bit of a rounded perspective on the issue of recruitment fees, which are no doubt a critical indicator of risk, but by no means the only one. And I think that whilst we need a bit more clarity on definition, in reality, we're dealing with workers that quite often appear at tier one, tier two, possibly tier three of the supply chain, and we're failing to take account of the workers that exist much further down the chain or who are sitting in the informal sector, who are brought into the supply chain through other informal means, through agency and contract work, through sub-agents, and those that are working in the home or through other channels. So I do think that this is an important issue, but I think the issue about freedom of association, the question of discrimination, the degree to which a worker can organize and collectively be represented in a negotiation with their employer, whether it's through a trade union or through another worker committee, I think is equally important for us to bear in mind. And I recognize this webinar is about responsible recruitment, but I think we mustn't think that this is the only issue that sits at the root of modern slavery.
Sure, no, it's very much part of a broader debate, of course. But thank you for that point, Cindy. It actually leads quite nicely into the next question I want to put to the panel, and it's around strategy to in audits, which are not a perfect solution, but it's probably the best solution we have. But when companies are doing audits, what are the strategies that they need to put in place to ensure they capture whether workers have paid recruitment fees, and perhaps, taking Cindy's wider point, are at risk of being involved in forced labour? Brent, do you want to take that point? So in auditing, what are the strategies specifically that you need to elicit to find out whether workers have paid fees or not?
Yeah, and again, I think, again, we need to avoid a one-size-fits-all. So in certain geographies, we do more than we do in other geographies on the basis of what we perceive to be the risk. But generally speaking, the first thing you have to do is to be clear as to what you're wanting to find through the audit process. So you need to think of what questions you're including in the audit protocols to enable an auditor to be able to continue to dive into a question to get to the heart of what the issues are. So we spend a lot of time training auditors to make sure that those who are involved in our business understand exactly what the purpose of the questions are, that the questions are subject to lower levels of questioning if they are getting concerns around the individuals. And we also have a big push for actually having interviews with workers. So as part of the audit process, the company will put together a range of different information for the auditor to use that will identify issues like employee numbers, gender, where they're from, if that information is known. And we use that to base the inquiry on in the particular facility or supplier that we are auditing at the time. And again, you just have to be prepared to go beyond the written question where there is a concern that this person might actually have been subject to in a previous role. As I said to you before, they may have been trafficked or subject to fees in a previous job and are still indebted and so therefore suffering forced labour and human trafficking. That's where you need to dig. But training of auditors is vital. You need people who are able to talk the language of the people they're interviewing. You need to have people who can gain the trust of workers, so you need to make sure your conversations are not known to management. Management is never told who is interviewed. They're done in a way where management is nowhere near. And if that's a problem, then we will actually arrange to have conversations with employees outside of work at a place of their own choosing in order for us to be able to dig down where we see there is a real risk that this has happened.
Thanks, Brent. Doug, do you have anything to add to that point? Specific strategies to really find out whether workers have been paying recruitment fees?
Well, I think Brent hit the nail on the head with it's about the auditor. And the competency. We've been encouraging and working with an organization to get it started over the last couple of years called the Association of Professional Social Compliance Auditors, APSCA for short. And, you know, as part of that, it is to raise the quality of auditors that do these type of audits, not just around responsible recruitment, but or forced labor, but you know, making sure they have training, making sure that there is a disciplinary body that oversees these auditors, much like in the U.S. you've got, you know, accounting bodies, you've got law bodies that kind of oversee the profession. We felt like that was a critical missing piece, that, you know, there ought to be some requirements and qualifications of good auditors, and they ought to be trained and mentored. And so that organization, I think, is going to play a key role going forward.
Great. Thanks, Doug. Different question, slightly different tack. All of these issues really require empowerment for workers, point that Brent made just now. And our next question is, how are members of the ETI and both Walmart and Coca-Cola ensuring that migrant workers in their supply chains are empowered and protected to tell the truth about recruitment costs and wider slavery issues. So what are you guys doing to empower workers so they can speak up about these things? Cindy, do you want to talk a little bit about what ETI members are doing?
Great. I think just to pick up on the last point and to respond to this one, ETI members are certainly behind efforts to improve the quality of audits, but they are also in empowering workers themselves and in addressing the risk question and the monitoring of their of these issues. They are increasingly turning to NGOs, other expert stakeholders at a local level to work with workers on these issues. There's a big effort to reach workers even before they migrate, not to warn them necessarily of the risks of migrating to a safer job, as many of the anti-trafficking NGOs have done in over many years, but to enable them to migrate safely, knowing what their rights are, having some kind of interlocutor that they can reach out to when they end up in the country or the place of work, where people speak their own language, where their rights are acknowledged, and really trying to address the situation of any worker, whether migrant or not, has got basic rights at work, and really helping them understand what they are and who they can turn to when things go wrong. We expect as well for those sending country governments to put in place some kind of whistleblowing mechanism or some kind of safe haven so that workers can go somewhere where their issues and concerns can be addressed. If their passports have been taken away from them, if they haven't been paid wages, if they have indeed paid recruitment fees and are being threatened, they need a safe haven. And I think it's local actors in those places that speak their language, that recognize those workers' rights, is absolutely key. And that isn't really the role of auditors. Their role of auditors is very different. So I think reaching out and identifying key stakeholders, including labor inspection authorities where appropriate, is part of the mix, and finding good paralegal institutions that can take up their cases or address those issues with their employers, I think often requires some external, independent and trusted third party.
Thanks, Cindy. Brent, turning to you then, you talked about some of the things you do to ensure that you give that employees get recruitment fees returned and everything else. But what's the secret to making them feel empowered that they can talk to you about these things? Because it's the changing of the culture that we've talked about already. So what's Coca-Cola doing to do that?
Yeah, I think Cindy's given a pretty big overview there. I mean, let's be honest. What we're talking about in many of these instances are people operating in environments where empowerment is weak, not just in terms of trade union power, but a lot of social civil society power. And so there are inherent vulnerabilities in the environment where these people are coming into. So what we try and do, and we've recently been undertaking quite a bit of work in our sugar study supply chain, which you can see on our website, where we looked at forced labor and child labor and land rights within now 15 countries are reported in terms of our sugar supply chain. And there, that issue about local actors was so important. I mean, we had to spend considerable time identifying who are the right people to talk to, because to Cindy's point, a lot of these people end up operating in levels of the supply chain which are very informal. And so even the trade unions who we partner with in many of these inquiries are unable to get to these workers. So you do need to spend a lot of time thinking about who are the right actors at the local level that you can engage with, that can give you the ability to talk to workers, or the workers will at least talk to them so that you can get a real picture of what's going on the ground. It's a massive task to do that. In many instances, those people aren't very well known. In many instances, civil society groups are not public. There are many parts of this world where being a civil society organization or a human rights defender is a very dangerous occupation to enter into. And so you need to be tolerant, respectful, but very thorough in making sure you try and find the right people that can help you give the workers the opportunity. In more stable environments where trade unionism is not provided for, like in the Gulf, you are able to do things with workers' committees, be that with health and safety or with accommodation or just general engagement with the workforce, where over time you can build trust so that people do feel comfortable that they can raise an issue through a local ombudsman or whoever has been appointed as the representative of the workers. But again, that takes time. You've got to build trust. We talked before about the fact that workers don't trust jobs if they don't pay fees. Well, again, workers don't often trust others who are trying to help them. And so you've got to do this doggedly in order to make sure that eventually you can get to a stage where people feel they can talk.
Thanks, Brent. Doug, how much do you recognize that for Walmart then? And what are you doing to ensure that the migrant workers in your supply chains do feel empowered to talk up about these issues?
Yeah, I think it's really important for us to lean on those NGOs that have already been mentioned because of our size and scale and how removed we are from the actual site. So that's, you know, I mentioned earlier, we're working with the Yitzhak Institute and they've created an app that empowers workers to actually speak out against labor brokers and as well as about their employers. And we're working with IOM and RLI to do a workplace program as well that does training and has a hotline and surveys. So NGOs, but I think also the grievance mechanisms. You know, just to give you one example that I haven't mentioned, and that's we're part of the Seafood Task Force, which is really digging into how do you tackle the catching of seafood and the farming of seafood, you know, not just like with shrimp. You know, if you haven't looked at how complex that supply chain is, look at it sometime in Thailand. But it's for that worker, that fisherman on the boat that catches the junk fish that goes into the fish food that ends up being fed to the shrimp. You know, how do you get that worker on that boat a voice? And so they've been exploring, and we're on the board of that, different models of worker voice, you know, from Labor Protection Network in Thailand, the Project Itsara, the Migrant Worker Rights Network, Oxfam, all of them kind of participating to say, okay, what does good look like? And it's not necessarily only one model, but learning from all of those and then giving the worker the voice to be able to speak out when problems are happening.
Okay, so thank you very much indeed. I want to combine a couple of questions that we just had and I'll go back to both to Brent and Doug. So what would happen at Coca-Cola and Walmart if somebody they another organization, someone like Cindy or another organization brought to your attention that the recruitment fees in your supply chain, and then what the measures you would take with a non-compliant supplier? Brent.
Well, again, it depends on the nature of what the event you're talking about, but we'd welcome the fact that people are having eyes on our supply chain. They can tell us if these things are occurring. And the first step would be to inquire as to what's going on. Go and talk to the supplier. Find out what the situation is. Why are they doing what they're doing? Talk to them about what our expectations are and requirements. See how we can help them move to compliance. It's very, very rare for us because of the nature of our supply chain and what we have is very long-term relationships with a lot of our suppliers to do a cut and run. But we will look to try and understand the problem and find a way to resolve it so the individual is reimbursed. And the solution for that will vary on a case-to-case basis. But we certainly wouldn't cut and run as the first instance. We'd sort of try to understand. Because the other thing, too, is in many of these supply situations, we may be a minor buyer of a big supplier. And if we're the only one that's asking for the non-payment of fees and the rest of this, their buyers are not, then you can get instances where they say, sorry, this isn't a business critical case. We'd rather not supply to you than change our behavior that nobody else is asking to change. So again, the collaboration piece that we've been doing for a number of years now is designed to try and make sure that these suppliers understand that it's not just one buyer that is going to ask them to adhere to these principles, but all of their buyers eventually will be.
Sure, absolutely. Back to the collaboration point. Doug, can I put that question to you then? Walmart finds recruitment fees in a supplier. What do you do about it? Or what's your initial reaction, rather? And then secondly, how do you deal with non-compliant suppliers?
I would echo what Brent said as far as we welcome it. Extra eyes on the supply chain always helps us. We do welcome that. If something comes in like that, what we would do is review it, look at the source, and then determine do we need to do an investigation. So we have a team of investigators that are trained in uncovering, for example, forced labor in different countries. And so we would probably send somebody out, two people maybe, to actually go talk to the facility, talk to the workers, to verify is this a valid allegation of typically it would be forced labor, or in this case responsible recruitment leading to forced labor as an indicator. And and so we would do an investigation to verify that. And then if we get to that point, then we discuss it internally, and then we bring in the supplier, talk to them, and have a discussion about how do we resolve this, and what are the consequences to the business relationship. But as Brent said, it's typically not cut and run. But we do want to take this seriously, and so we have. A system you can see on our website, our responsible sourcing section, that talks about, they have strikes against suppliers, for certain violations, and if you get enough strikes, you're out at that point.
Sure. I mean, I guess nobody benefits from a cut and run approach. Final right. question. We're coming to the end of our time, but final question. I want to put this to Cindy. The pace of change, is it quick enough in the industry? And what more, Cindy, do you want to see companies doing to really drive scale to really deal with the recruitment fee issue and wider modern slavery issues? Cindy.
Thank you. I think that the pace of change in a complex environment is very difficult. And if you have knee-jerk responses and quick fix templates to try and address these issues, I think you could end up inadvertently causing more damage than good. So I do think that the seriousness with which a number of big companies are taking this is really important. The critical question of the many smaller companies that don't have the leverage that Coca-Cola and Walmart have, and the need for collaboration, the need to incentivize the flagging of issues and the coming together in a pre-competitive space to collectively increase leverage in addressing this issue is really important. Building trust takes time. I think entering into relationships between buyers, suppliers, and their own clients and customers down the line, and importantly with workers themselves, I think is a process that has begun but needs to be ramped up, with the worker's own needs at the forefront of this agenda, rather than trying to manage simply corporate risk at the lowest cost. And I know that that's going to take time, but I do think that these efforts that are currently underway are salutary and important and can help us point the way to a more effective approach, where there's a recognition that audits are not enough on their own, that we need to engage with a wide range of actors and approach this in a context-specific way as well.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. I'm going to have to stop the discussion now as we have run out of time. Can I thank our panel very much for their expert insight this afternoon. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on business, human rights and modern slavery risks, then please do join us in October. There are plenty more free podcasts and other content on these issues on the Innovation Forum website, so do check that out and subscribe to our podcast and newsletter. We'll send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. I've been Ian Welsh, and thank you for listening.